Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM Program Director Allison Sansoni chats with author and historian Aaron Sachs about his new book, Up From the Depths, Herman Melville, Lewis Mumford, and Rediscovery in Dark Times. This conversation originally took place June 7th, 2022, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. We want to thank all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. The AWM and its permanent exhibits includes many of the venerated writers of the past, and we recognize that as times change, so too does interest in different aspects of literary history. Some writers remain well-known throughout the years. Others come into popularity, fall out of it again, and are rediscovered time after time by those seeking the relevance of their words. Tonight's program looks at two writers whose popularity rose and fell during their own lifetimes and many times afterwards, as well as about the reckoning with modernity that both addressed in their work. In Up From the Depths, Aaron Sachs tells the interconnected stories of novelist Herman Melville and one of his earliest biographers, the literary critic and historian Lewis Mumford. Mumford helped spearhead Melville's revival in the aftermath of World War I and the 1918 flu pandemic, when American culture needed a forebear with a suitably dark vision. His work on Melville's biography reminded Americans that darkness was balanced with a fierce determination to endure despair and persevere. Dr. Sachs is a professor of history and American studies at Cornell University. He is the author of The Humboldt Current, 19th Century Exploration and the Roots of American Environmentalism, and Arcadian America, The Death and Life of an Environmental Tradition. We're so pleased to have him here with us tonight, and let's welcome him back into the room.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that lovely introduction, and thanks to everybody in the Zoom room.
It's great. It's great to see everyone. I understand to start us off, you have a portion of the book you'd like to read for us.
Yeah. And what I'm really looking forward to is the conversation. But yeah, I thought it would be great to just start off with a little hint of the book. I didn't want to give too much away. So I'm starting with something very early from the book. It's actually from chapter one, the beginning of chapter one, and the title of chapter one is Loomings, which many of you probably know, is also the chapter title for the very first chapter of Moby Dick. And I have to say, one of the most fun things about doing this project was just consistently stealing words and phrases from Melville, which I think he would have approved of because he did a lot of that himself. But anyway, so this is chapter one, Loomings. Do you know any optimistic historians? There aren't many. Spend almost any length of time studying the past, and the rosiest conclusion you'll come to is that our record is, well, mixed. Every time we take 100 steps forward, we take 99 back, and it's unclear where the next one is going to land. For every scholar willing to claim that, say, the 1950s were a great era in American history, when the income gap closed and opportunity knocked at everyone's door, 100 others will remind you that not everyone had a door, that there was a war in Korea, that some veterans were drinking too much and beating their wives, that women were kept from the workforce, that African Americans were kept from voting, that children grew up with air raid drills, that artists were blacklisted and intellectuals jailed for controversial opinions, that synagogues were bombed, that radiation and toxic chemicals were seeping into everyone's bodies. Sorry, I feel like I should have warned you that we were going to plunge right into the Melvillian abyss, but I promise we'll come up again. because pessimism does not exclude the possibility of hope. Because history teaches that things do shift. The most dour among us will argue that all change just represents entropy, the inevitable drift toward further chaos. But then why didn't nature reclaim our cities centuries ago? Yes, we are part of the chaos, but we also sometimes struggle against it. We create culture, make meaning, insist on ideals like liberty, equality, and solidarity, sometimes with startling, unpredictable success. Lewis Mumford's first book, published in 1922, just before he turned 27, was The Story of Utopias. It was, of course, a story of failure, because utopia is an impossible dream. But the point was the value of the dreamer, the restless striving toward collective thriving, the determined envisioning of alternatives to hierarchy and domination. If there was no such thing as a perfect place, there could at least be a good place, like the TV show, which Mumford sometimes referred to as utopia with an E at the beginning, drawing on the Greek root in words like eulogy and euphonious. And he argued that our collective will to utopia was in fact the only thing preventing society's disintegration. Predictably, for the rest of his life, Mumford would have to fend off the label of dreamy utopian, and that drove him crazy. In his 1940 book, Faith for Living, he included an entire chapter called Life is Better Than Utopia. And when he issued a new edition of the story of utopias in 1962, he cantankerously reminded his readers that my utopia is actual life. What he always returned to was the need in any half-decent society to protect people's ability to protest and resist, to contest dominant values, which so often serve merely to keep the powerful in power. Unlike utopian writers, he said, I must find a place in any proposed scheme for challenge and opposition and conflict. In short, to be a utopian with an E meant to believe in the constant open renegotiation of what the good society should be in the face of stiffening conventions and constraints, meant embracing hope despite what he called ever looming ordeals of reality. That phrase, ordeals of reality, is another chapter title from the very last book Mumford published, a memoir he wrote just before the onset of dementia. And that phrase, ordeals of reality, referred to the period when he was working on his Melville biography from 1927 to 1929. He started work on the Melville Project under congenial circumstances. Summer, Martha's Vineyard, with his wife, Sophia, and their two-year-old son, in, as he said, a shabby little shack on a lonely heath. The sea, again in his words, was their constant companion, washing against the cliffs, whispering or roaring, soothing or threatening, advancing or retreating. And nearby was an ancient tree-lined farm worked by two elderly women. Mumford delighted in the flow and ebb, the stimulation and repose of the landscape. A ridge of sandy cliffs, skirting the shores for a couple of miles until they sank into dunes, marked the abrupt end of the land. And at the bottom of these cliffs, we sunned ourselves and bathed. It was a refuge, a retreat. Many members of the Lost Generation escaped the trauma of the First World War by immersing themselves in nature and seeking inspiration from the past. Up to this point, Mumford had been ensconced in New York City, and he still lived there in the fall, winter, and spring. But in his writing throughout the 1920s, he had already begun to search historical landscapes for ways of transcending his life amid skyscrapers and offsetting his society's fixation on power and conquest. Unlike most 1920s intellectuals, though, who generally looked to Europe for alternatives to the conservatism dominating the United States, Mumford dove ever deeper into American cultural history. After The Story of Utopias, he published Sticks and Stones, a study of American architecture and civilization, in which he proposed the classic Massachusetts village as, in his words, the embodiment of a highly intelligent partnership between the earth and man. Then in his breakthrough book, The Golden Day, A Study in American Literature and Culture, Mumford wrote even more yearningly of old New England, celebrating the efflorescence of imagination in the 1840s and 50s, noting the outdoor energy of antebellum poetry and prose, the embrace of both science and art, modernity and timelessness. The Golden Day established writers like Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, Hawthorne, Poe, and Melville as the archetypal American geniuses, sparking a new scholarly movement to appreciate what we now call the American Renaissance. The clear heroes of that book were Emerson and Whitman, and either could easily have served as the subject of a new biography. But Mumford chose Melville. Perhaps he wanted to embrace tragedy as openly as possible, to shake off the public's perception that he was primarily a nostalgic utopian. Perhaps he truly craved a dose of darkness, found it exhilarating to follow Melville, in Mumford's words, in a flight over an unconquered and perhaps an unconquerable abyss. Or perhaps he wanted to redeem Melville. As he said, Melville's perplexities, his defiances, his torments, his questions, even his failures, all have a meaning for us. Thanks. I'm going to stop there and really looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. I wanted to start us off with a little bit of a chicken or an egg question. How did you come to this subject? Was it an interest in Melville or Mumford or both?
Definitely both. I have about 10 different origin stories for this book. The simplest one to tell is that in 2004, I was at the Friends of the Library book sale in Ithaca, New York. And it was my first semester as a professor, and I was quite dazed. I had an 11-month-old son, and I saw on the bookshelf what seemed to be a biography of Melville by Lewis Mumford, and I did one of these, like, really? because I knew both writers, but I didn't know about this biography. I had read other books by Lewis Mumford. I had read a lot of Melville. But anyway, I picked it up and I was hooked, and that, just the existence of that biography and then the discovery that it made a huge difference in the Melville revival, just made me think a lot about, what was going on. Made me think historically, what was going on in the 1920s to make it so that Melville seemed like such an incredibly relevant writer.
Yeah, what was happening in the world that we went back to a whaling ship?
Yeah, especially since, what do you learn about the 20s? You hear it's the roaring 20s. It's, it's the great explosion of the American economy and consumer society and all of that. But turns out to have been a darker time. And that was one of Mumford's sort of obsessions, was always to think about the countercurrents in any given moment. When we're sort of casually thinking back to the history of the 20th century, we say the roaring 20s and then the depression hit. And one of Mumford's ideas was like, the roaring 20s wasn't so great after all, but that also helps us see the positive side of things that were going on in the 1930s during the depression.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the, we've looked at back at a lot of writing that took place in the 20s, and what we think of as excess makes perfect sense to us now after the past 2 years as a trauma response, doesn't it? It's you're thinking to yourself, well, that makes a lot of more sense to me than it did before.
Yeah, and Mumford thought really, really hard about trauma at both the personal and the societal level. And he wrote the Melville biography, which actually sent him into a deep depression because Melville was so dark. and then the depression hit, And you know, everyone was traumatized. But then the great, he has this moment. He wrote a book immediately after the Melville biography called The Brown Decades. And it's a really extraordinary book, came out in 1930. And there's this moment where he's sort of thinking out loud in the book and realizing, like, you know what, the Depression, when it hit in 1929, it felt awfully similar to what happened right after World War I. 1919 was a dismal year in American history with lynchings and just, you know, all sorts of rioting, really, really, really terrible stuff. And a lot of Melville's circle felt like it was the beginning of a new dark time. And he started to really think cyclically and realize that, you know, even though in our culture we're trained to think that time is only linear and we just move constantly forward, and you know, the past is irrelevant and anyway irretrievable because we've come so far from those dark days of history. But Mumford started thinking, no, there's also a great deal of continuity, and it's worth sort of thinking about that dialectic between linear and cyclical time.
Yeah. One of the things that we really grapple with at the American Writers Museum is the idea of relevance, that not every writer from history is still read today. So how writers are chosen to become part of the American canon, how they're considered in their time and in ours are both of great interest to us. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the sort of Melville Renaissance that you've alluded to, and how Mumford played a role in spurring that.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks. So, like I said, 1919 was a terribly dark year in a lot of ways in American society. It also happened to be the centennial of Melville's birth. And a couple of obscure literary scholars noticed that, and sort of just started writing an article here and there about Melville to say, like, you know, maybe there could be something in this guy, especially for this dark time. And it just sort of caught on. The first biography was by Raymond Weaver in 1921. And it was literally a rediscovery, because Melville had been just utterly forgotten. Not only since he died in 1891, but for the last few decades of his life, when he was still alive, a lot of people thought he had already died because he was so obscure. So there were no biographies written of him until Raymond Weaver came along in 1921. And then there was this explosion. People did find him to be very, very relevant, germane to the times. And Mumford was just starting his career in the early 1920s. And initially was much more attracted to Emerson and Whitman. But then after Weaver's biography came out and he started really thinking about this period that we now call the American Renaissance in the 1830s and 40s and 50s in New England with all of those, and New York with all of those amazing writers. And he started thinking, like, you know, some of them really understood injustice in different and more powerful ways. Just as an example, the injustice surrounding especially slavery in those times. Melville has a huge amount to say about slavery. And just to give you one concrete example of why that resonated in the 1920s, the KKK, which had been fairly dormant in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, exploded again suddenly in the 1920s. It was really a very conservative period in a lot of ways, an anti-immigrant period. And Melville also has a great deal to say about immigrants and you know, the sort of the rights that immigrants have in coming to the United States in the 19th century. So anyway, Mumford saw the whole period, the antebellum period, in a much darker light after reading more Melville and thinking about him, and then wrote this biography, which came out in 1929, and sort of supplanted Raymond Weaver's work and became the go-to book about Melville that then spurred even more scholarly work. There was really an explosion of scholarly work about Melville through the 30s and 40s, and then especially surrounding 1951, which was the centenary of Moby Dick. That's the moment when you could say Melville was finally canonized.
Yeah. We, in reading your book and you know, and listening to you talk now, we think of these reconsiderations of the classics as something new, something, you know, we've never done before. We talk about it as if it's some sort of betrayal of the past, but I think your book makes it clear that these reconsiderations have been happening all along throughout literary history and in every era, looking back and saying, does this writer still have something to say? And Mumford seems to have settled pretty definitively on yes, to that Melville did have something to say in his time. And you are, in your writing, are saying that Mumford and Melville both have something to say to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope there will be a Mumford revival. I think he's incredibly relevant right now. But yeah, the broader point that you're making is really, really important. And it's something that Mumford wrote a lot about. Basically, the idea is we constantly have to be going back and rethinking our relationship to the past. It's really like the past is always with us. It's even though we live in this culture where we often deny that in subtle and unsubtle ways, it's there. It's affecting us every single day. And if we don't rethink, renegotiate that relationship, then we're sort of, you know, the more powerless to deal with that influence. And that includes rethinking, you know, who should be in any sort of canon, if you're going to have a literary canon in the first place. But that process has been so important through time, and each generation really has to have its own active, constructive relationship to the past and past writers. You can see this in sort of obvious ways with regard to recovering, for instance, African-American writers, women writers, all sorts of people from various minority groups who just were ignored in the past. That's a fairly straightforward kind of recovery or rediscovery or renegotiation. But then there are also important ways of renegotiating that relationship that address sort of more subtle things. You know, the way that Melville turned out to have a kind of modernist sensibility before modernism existed. And that's another reason people were so excited about him, is that he had a way of writing that was often panned at the time. You know, the classic reviews of Moby Dick say, like, look, either give us a really good story about the chase after a white whale or give us a whaling manual. We don't want both at the same time. And that's just what modernists tend to, that kind of thing, that kind of interweaving of different sorts of things is just what modernists tend to want. And so yeah, it's that act of rediscovery can be incredibly helpful and illuminating at any moment in history.
Yeah. I don't want to say contrarian, because that sort of implies a kind of knee-jerk reactionism, but I am interested in the idea that they both looked at the prevailing sentiment of the day and decided to interrogate that rather than go along to get along.
Yeah, definitely. Melville said explicitly that he wanted to write the kind of books that would be seen as failures, because he was so just sort of frustrated by, I mean, the market economy was fairly new. The idea that you could even make a living potentially as a writer was fairly new, but it was very, really, really hard. And there were all these commercial concerns that people wanted him to take into consideration. And there were some books he wrote, you know, in order to try to make a living. But then, you know, he also wrote works that were just, you know, like, let's say really displeasing to the majority of his readers, because they were so different from what was expected. And I think part of that was a kind of contrariness in a way. It was basically to say screw you to the market and to the obligation to exist in this market economy. But also, you know, to see it in a more positive light, it was an expression of who he really was. You know, he was the kind of person who got very, very involved in his characters and his stories, but also, you know, really cared about the whaling manuals, you know, really wanted to learn about the world and, you know, how it worked, you know. So Moby Dick is this great symbol. It's this symbol that has, you know, allowed for countless interpretations. But at the same time, in the book, it's an actual living whale in an ecology. You know, the word ecology wasn't around yet, but like in an ocean ecology, which is described in great detail and subtlety in the book. So yeah, anyway, contrarian, but also just trying to be true to himself, and Mumford was the same way.
I want to move into talking a little bit about your own writing process. You move back and forth between Melville's story and Mumford's. How did you decide to structure this book and give weight to different aspects of their lives?
Thank you so much for asking that question, because I really care a lot about that. And again, I have many, many different responses, and maybe we can sort of gradually go through a few of them as we exchange ideas about this. But for starters, you know, it is meant to be an homage to the kind of writing that Melville often did, as in Moby Dick. There's that sort of interwovenness, that alternating effect that I think is very, very powerful. And it makes you follow the thread of the story in a different way. You never quite know what's going on. I actually like my reader to be a little bit lost and then sort of offer up some orientation gradually so that they're kind of making connections along with me as they're reading. So that's one answer. And then one other one that I'll just sort of underline for now has to do with, again, this question of time and change and continuity. I had things to say about how each of these writers developed over time. They both have a chronological trajectory in the book, but just as important as that to me was the resonances between their lives and work and time periods. So I already mentioned that realization that Mumford had in 1929, like, oh, the Great Depression is not that much of a shock because it feels very similar actually to 10 years ago. Another sort of realization that he had layered on top of that was, oh, and those two shocks were not as different as you might think from the shock of the Civil War, the trauma of the Civil War. You know, he says explicitly, I realized I could only understand my time once I went back and studied what was happening in the 19th century and the way that people tried to recover from the shock of the Civil War. So those kinds of resonances, and there are many more examples, but just that basic idea that there's this continuity as well as change, and they're woven together, and The past is always with us in the present. That was something I really wanted to explore structurally, not just thematically. I've always really loved books where the form of the book somehow fits with the substance of the book, and that was what I was going for.
Were you aware of all of those points of connection when you began, or were there things that emerged in your research that you said, oh my goodness, look at all of these commonalities?
Definitely both. Yeah, there were some things that had leapt to mind as soon as I started thinking about the project. I mentioned that book, The Brown Decades, is full of these resonances. But also a lot of them only came to light as I did more and more research, not only reading their public works, but going into the archives and reading as many private writings. I mean, all of Melville is published at this point, although he burned a lot of his documents. And so there's just a lot we don't know about his life and his thoughts. Mumford is the opposite. He's really over-documented. He kept note of everything and kept journals all through his life. But those were really, really fun and interesting to read. And he was incredibly honest with himself in his private writings. Some of the resonances in their lives are really kind of uncanny. And it became important to me to really sort of try to work that through in this text and see, you know, what further meanings I could make from that. That sounded a little abstract. So just to give you one example, one of the things I realized is that both of these men really, really cared about the idea of relationships or relationality, and their marriages were incredibly important. I really wanted to get the voices of their wives into the book as much as possible. And I wound up having two chapters at the very end of the book. It so happened that both men died, and then their wives were left to sort of reflect on their lives and think about their legacy. I hope in those two chapters at the end that you can really see some of the similarities between the two relationships and also some of the differences that were, you know, related to historical changes, but also, of course, just personal differences.
Did you imagine an audience for this book as you were writing it? Were you anticipating that many people would be fans of one or both, or were you primarily writing for scholars or both?
Yeah, I mean, I try always to write for a broad audience. I hope that there's plenty there for scholars, but I hope there's also plenty there for anybody who is interested in Melville, or anyone who's interested in Mumford, or anyone who's interested in, you know, what it means to think historically and be in a constructive relationship with the past. Pretty broad, and you know, I took some direct inspiration in that from Mumford, who really tried to be a public intellectual all through basically almost all of the 20th century. Really did some incredibly deep scholarly work, but also really tried to be a force in his culture.
Something that struck me as I was reading is about the round and round and round of history and pandemic and war and modernization was that both writers had this idea about communal obligation and to endure, to better oneself, to make the world better for others, to honor nature. A lot of these things are being written about today. And I'm wondering what Melville and Mumford both have to say to us about our current moment.
Yeah, thanks for that. There's so much to say, but I'll start with the image of the ship that comes up in so many of Melville's works. You know, it's this it's this place where you can very, very clearly see hierarchy, right? Because there's a captain, there are first mates, there are second mates, there's all down the line, and everybody, it's pretty militaristic, even if it's not a military ship. And Melville was keenly aware of that, suffered from that in his own experiences as a sailor. And yet he found there to be this incredible potential for solidarity and understanding across difference. Moby Dick is about everything, I guess. But one of the things it's about is cross-cultural understanding. You have people on the Pequod from all over the world with all kinds of different backgrounds. And Melville consistently explores in the novel what it takes to sort of cross over those differences. And he doesn't make it easy, right? I mean, when Ishmael and Queequeg first encounter each other, they almost kill each other, or at least they're afraid. Ishmael's afraid that Queequeg is going to kill him and eat him. But eventually they wind up rubbing foreheads together and feeling as though they are married, wedded together. And this also, you know, the Melville is also very, very aware of American individualism. He calls everybody on the Pequod an isolado. And yet, as they go forth on this mission, even though it's a strange mission, he says they become federated along one keel. They're all in it together. They find commonality, and you know, in a way, they find commonality in the face of severe threats, and you know, under the sort of cloud of these hierarchies and this sense of danger. So anyway, yeah, I could go on and on, but maybe let that stand as one example of how Melville thought about, you know, the division that there are always going to be divisions in society. It's going to be hard, but you know, one of the things I love about him is that he always looked for that sense of possibility, even in the direst circumstances.
And Mumford.
Yeah, okay. So lots of examples to choose from, but Mumford, I would say even more than Melville, was relentlessly constructive. I mean, he's willing to go dive into the abyss, but then insists on, he's, you know, he sort of says in so many words, you have to remember to come up out of the abyss and try to make something out of this confrontation with reality, try to offset all of the forces of evil and wrong that are inevitably going to be there in society. There's a kind of determined realism that I think both of these authors really uphold. And for Mumford, maybe the best example is just the idea of the city. I think he's often been mischaracterized as simply a critic of the city, because he does, you know, he takes a very, very hard look at the injustices of the city, the poverty of the city, the way that, you know, some people have access to green spaces and other people don't. But, you know, he takes that criticism and tries to reimagine what a city can be. He says, let's go from the megalopolis example to a series of sort of small to medium-sized garden cities with lots of green spaces interwoven throughout them. And, you know, with some industry, people can maybe walk to work, and also some wilderness on the immediate outskirts of the city. Basically, just, you know, taking what is truly a mess, the urban scene by the early to mid 20th century was really, really problematic, and saying we're not going to give up on it, we're going to make it worth everybody's while and as equally as possible.
I want to thank you for this extraordinary conversation. It's a wonderful event. Thank you so much for being here with us tonight. And thank you, Erin.
And thank you. This was such a privilege to get to do this. I'm really grateful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, writer Vincent Tirado discusses their young adult novel, Burn Down, Rise Up, with journalist Andrew Davis, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.